Welcome to a special bonus episode of Future Makers, in which I have a discussion with Mark Carney, the Governor of the Bank of England. He kindly invited us in to talk about climate change and the role of financial institutions in helping to deal with it. I hope you enjoy the discussion, which I certainly found very enlightening. We're here in the Bank of England to discuss climate change with Mark Carney. Mark, thank you very much for inviting us. But I imagine some people might be surprised to hear that the climate is a major concern of the Governor of the Bank of England. Do you think they should be surprised?
Well, I can understand that some might be surprised that we take a direct interest in climate change, but that's in part probably because they don't know that we are the supervisor of the fourth largest insurance industry in the world. And if you supervise insurance companies who provide insurance on homes or businesses, or who provide what's called reinsurance of major risks around the world, insurance against hurricanes, other natural disasters, you realize that we have to take climate change seriously as a risk just for those firms themselves, because it's in many respects the number one risk that they have to manage. And I'm happy to report that the UK insurance industry is very, very good at managing these risks. However, part of being very good about managing climate change risks, physical risks from climate change, if you're an insurer, is that you tend to raise your prices because those risks are going up, and you also tend to reduce your coverage. So there'll be homes that didn't used to be in regularly flooded areas that no longer are covered, or commercial real estate, office buildings in Florida that get hit by hurricanes more frequently, and therefore it doesn't make economic sense for the company to provide that coverage. And that's part of the dynamic that's been happening over the last three decades, is that we've seen the number of extreme weather events, not just bad weather, extreme weather events around the world that have been insured has gone up three times, and the losses on those events have gone up an average of five times, and that's inflation-adjusted losses. So quite significant changes to the risk profile. There are much bigger losses that are uninsured, and quite often in the poorest parts of the world as well. And that in and of itself would be enough to justify our interest and necessitate our interest. But there is a broader set of issues around the financial system as a whole, because there are two types of risks that come from climate change as it affects the financial system. So think banks, for example. The first is the impact of physical risks. I just talked about them for insurance companies. In general, for banks, in general, they don't have big exposures to those physical risks relative to the size of all their lending, for example. And they also lend in a relatively short horizon, so 3, 4, 5 years out, with the exception of mortgages, obviously, but 3, 4, 5 years out. And so when the bigger physical risks manifest themselves, when they happen, the banks think they'll be able to adjust their business models and their lending accordingly. But they're also subject to a second type of risk. The entire financial system is subject to a second type of risk, which, of course, is also an opportunity, but let me explain, which is a so-called transition risk. So as we know, the United Kingdom, through Parliament, has taken the decision to move to a net zero economy, net zero carbon economy by 2050. And that's a big change to our economy. I'm sure we'll talk more about that. But it means that certain industries that are very highly carbon intensive, if they don't adjust, those firms in those industries will cease to exist. Other industries that provide renewables or are much more efficient with respect to energy usage and providing goods and services to us, they will expand and there'll be opportunities. And the question that every financial firm is going to have to ask themselves is, are they well positioned for the adjustments in the economy? Now, just to draw the thoughts together, if I may, the transition risk is the adjustment to the economy because of changes to government policy and what that causes in return, new technologies that the private sector could come up with, regulations that could stop certain activities, prices on pollution and other factors which change the economics of decisions. So these are very fundamental risks that affect the system. And as a consequence of all those, because we oversee the world's leading international financial system, we've taken an interest in getting some of the building blocks in place so the system can adapt accordingly.
So this is anticipating future government action and making sure that the financial system and companies are ready to adapt.
Well, it's recognizing that if we are going to fulfill the law of the land, if the country is going to move to net zero over the course of the next several decades, then virtually every financial asset is going to be repriced over time. Some positively, they'll go up, others negatively. And it's uncertain the speed with which that'll happen, partly depends on government policy. It also depends on what happens in terms of new technologies coming in into play. It depends on societal attitudes. We've seen big shifts in people's use of non-disposable cups, for example. I mean, it seems like a small example, but actually there are a series of adjustments that happen, and businesses have to take those into account and anticipate them, and the financial sector has to support that.
And can you spell out the role of the central bank?
I talked about the physical risks, but I'll focus on these transition risks. So how can the system support the transition? We're not going to dictate the speed of the transition. That's the job for consumers and government and government regulation. But we need certain building blocks so the financial system is ready for that transition. And in some cases, it might even pull forward that transition. I'll get to that at the end. So the first building block is information. They need information from companies that banks lend to or that our pension funds and others invest in. What is, for example, the carbon footprint of that company and how does it compare to others? That's a point in time measure. And as you can appreciate, what's really interesting is where is that carbon footprint going? Does the company have a strategy for reducing that carbon footprint? How feasible is that strategy? Or possibly, and there are examples of this, does the company not take the transition seriously? Does it think the government actually won't take the measures that are necessary, or that the science is not quite as compelling as I think you or I would, and many listening would think it is? So we need information first. That's the first building block.
And the bank is part of that, is it?
Well, what we did is about 4 years ago this time, we, as part of the Paris Agreement process, we worked with a group of other regulators to commission the private sector to come up with standards for providing this information. So there were common standards for companies around the world to provide both that static short-term information, how much carbon are they producing, and dynamic information, where are they heading in terms of how much carbon they produce, what's the governance of it, how is management compensated, all these types. And what's happened over the course of the last 4 years is there is now investors, large banks, large insurance companies around the world controlling balance sheets of $120 trillion saying they now want this information, this standard, and the companies are beginning to respond. So we put in place that aspect. The second big thing we do as a central bank is we oversee not just the insurance companies, but the banks, the building societies, the core of the financial system. We are just launching, actually, this month as we speak, we're just launching a process called a stress test of those banks. And the stress test is not the usual type of stress test we like giving them, which is, oh, imagine a big recession and a global financial crisis, and do you have enough resources to withstand it? It's to say to those banks, if you took your lending today, your balance sheet, and you projected it out 10 years from now, 15, 20, 30 years to when we get to net zero, how would it look? How many of those companies, based on their current strategies for adjusting to climate change, adjusting to net zero, that transition, how many of those companies would be viable?
And this is based on government policy.
Yeah, well, the assumption is that, you assume that, it seems a fair assumption that we'll actually do what is the law of the land.
Indeed. So you're not in this process, as it were, predicting what the climate will be. You're factoring in the government's efforts to ameliorate
exactly
that.
It happens to be that we are predicting what the climate will be as well as a separate set of issues. But the bigger risks in terms of potential, the long-term risks are, of course, all about the climate. Yeah. But the bigger risks in terms of potential losses or gains on their lending portfolio relates to, let's take the simple example of a price on carbon. If the price on carbon is, £30 a ton today, roughly, and it goes up to 150, 200, 250 pounds a ton, which may be required ultimately to get to net zero, how does their lending portfolio look at that point?
So when you do these stress tests, you're not only looking at current government policy or...
Absolutely. It's all about the future. And if I may, this is one of the... It's how one we have to look at risk, because
sure.
these are risks to come.
Cool.
And there's a fancy term for it. Our fancy term is strategic resilience. So is your strategy as a bank or as an insurance company resilient to not just the physical changes of climate, but the changes in policy that will come if we as a society are going to achieve net zero?
It must be quite difficult to predict changes in future policy.
It is difficult at one level. You can reduce it to something as simple as a carbon tax. I mean, there are various estimates of carbon taxes that would be consistent with the transition pathway, so-called transition pathway to net zero. Climate policy is multifaceted. There'll be price on pollution. There'll be subsidies for certain activities. There'll be regulations against other activities. There'll be government spending in favor of certain things, and on and on and on.
And there might be new technologies, right?
Well, one expects that there will be new technologies.
How do you factor that in?
Well, I don't think you can assume cold fusion in these things, so you can't. There's no instant get out of.
And that's not going to be a stress if it comes about.
It's not right. a stress if you assume that.
Right. So, do you normally assume no radical novelties on the technological front?
We won't assume that.
Right.
As the economics changes, for existing technologies, ways of producing whatever, a good, a service, an intermediate good or final good, that provides a bigger incentive for that new technology. That's how the economy moves forward.
Yes.
It's what happens when this happens all the time outside of something like climate change, where just our preferences change for, you know, the price of avocados goes up because we.
But presumably, a government publicly announcing and encouraging its central bank to take seriously that things are going to happen with regard to climate change itself hugely incentivizes businesses to change their practices.
I think the jury is still out on that with respect to government policy, by which I mean that this country, relative internationally, I'll say, has had relatively coherent climate strategies and is closer to the forefront of those strategies and fairly ambitious intentions, net zero by 2050. But it's still relatively early days. And if one looks at carbon pathways, carbon price pathways and others, where the carbon price might need to go, there was a way to travel. Now, if I can make one point, which is that what financial markets will do, financial firms and investors will do, is that as that government policy, not with respect to the central bank, but with respect to prices on carbon and other things, as that government policy becomes credible, then the market will pull forward future adjustment. It will anticipate that the continuing ratcheting up, if you will, of climate policy, pull forward adjustment today because it's profitable to get ahead of that adjustment, and then that makes the job easier.
And how far do you think companies adapting what they do will be in response to what's happening in their finance? I mean, how much of it will be anticipating where they need to be in 20 years' time, and how much that they're actually getting pressure from their insurers and so on?
Well,
and lenders.
It's a mixture of both. The best companies lead and the worst are lag. In any structural change, you were, I think, last year on this podcast talking about artificial intelligence.
That's right.
And you think about we're very early days in terms of the implications of AI, machine learning, big data, components of the same thing, in terms of their implications for virtually every business and activity, including central banking. We're very early days for that. But the companies that get out in front of those or who are early adopters will do better, and some will just ultimately be blindsided by it.
Sure.
So this is a whole economy transition, which means that every financial asset is ultimately affected by it, some a little, some a lot, some positively, some negatively. And the consequence of that is that if somebody's running a bank or an insurance company or investing our money in a pension fund or something else, and they're not anticipating the types of changes that are going to happen, both positively and negatively, then they're going to lose a lot of money. What we get concerned about is We don't know the pace of this transition. Depends on lots of things. You rightly mentioned technological change. It matters on government policy. It matters on, you know, society's attitudes to certain products. We don't know the pace. But what we do know is that it will be a smoother adjustment, particularly for the in the financial sector, but for the economy, if people have information and they're managing that. This is a market. They will have different views about the speed with which things will change. That's a good thing. You don't want everybody betting in one direction, everyone thinking it's going to be fine, and then find out that there has to be a sharp adjustment, or everyone thinking it's going to be a disaster and not investing money in some ideas, some of which will work and others won't.
Right. So it's actually a strength of the market that you can adapt to uncertain circumstances.
It is absolutely a strength of the market.
But would you feel in general that enough people are taking climate seriously enough?
Again, I'd say the UK is, my experience, towards the forefront of climate policy itself, and certainly in terms of the financial sector is at the forefront in terms of adjusting, you know, thinking about these risks, managing these risks. But I'd also say that with at virtually everything else with respect to climate change, it's not moving fast enough.
Right. It's not moving fast enough in the UK.
The UK is at the forefront, and even in the UK, it's not fast enough.
Right. But what about the rest of the world?
Because the rest of the world is lagging behind the UK. Is that a disaster story? We should be. Our glasses are still half full as we speak. It means that more needs to be done. Our feeling at the bank is that collectively in the UK, and COP26 will be a crucial year, and the UK co-chairing that is vital, we have a very good sense of what needs to be done in the financial sector. You need, if you forgive the alliteration, we need reporting, so that information, the disclosure. We need risk management, when I talked about looking, stress testing the banks. And then we also need those who invest our money on our behalf, whether it's insurance company, pension, whatever, or ISA, to think about when they're targeting a return on that money to take into account the impact on climate change. Because ultimately, over time, that will be one of the biggest determinants of the value of those assets. And we need them to start thinking about it now. They have to have the information, and then they have to go through the processes. And this, we're starting to move in that direction. And the mainstreaming of these judgments is what needs to happen in the next few years. I'm more optimistic than not that will happen. But I'm not going to sit here and say that is the case today.
And do you see Britain playing a particular role? I mean, presumably, if things are established in Britain on a good footing, then other countries may be inclined to...
Well, absolutely. And it's a natural leader. I think the UK has taken leadership role in terms of, first G7 to legislate net zero.
And is that specifically because of Britain's financial muscle or political?
Well, I think on the first, it's a choice. It's a choice of, you know, Parliament representing us all. And I think there is strong support for that. It's not for me to say, but that's my impression. Certainly in the election, there was no disagreement about that objective. But in terms of the financial sector, what we see is that the expertise around identifying and managing these risks, a lot of the expertise is resident in the UK. And we can use the next year, particularly because of COP26 and, you know, our hosting it, and the focus and the strength of the financial sector to really leapfrog on that, move farther ahead. And if it's happening in the world's leading financial center, which is the UK, others will catch up.
Right. And presumably this could also happen in the technology sector, that if in Britain our companies are leading the way, developing new technologies, then that makes it easier for other countries to follow.
Well, some of the basic technologies, some of the technology which would appear to have some of the widest applications, whether it's in material sciences, graphene, others, or in AI. In fact, as you I'm sure know, that grid optimization and other applications there are one of the big energy savings. There is a global thirst for these technologies. So if we supply them, others will apply them. But if others come up with them, we'll be looking to import them.
Yeah. We mentioned earlier the idea of a carbon tax as a contributor to the solution. If a carbon tax is brought in, what do you see the role of organisations like the Bank of England as being, or do you think such a tax would be set centrally? How would that happen?
It's better to have those taxes moving slowly and predictably, and in the case of the carbon tax, slowly and predictably upwards. And as we were talking earlier, the more credible that process is, the more the market will anticipate, oh, if it's, for example, £75 per ton today, it'll be 100 in a few years' time. So when I make this investment today, I'm going to anticipate that future carbon tax, even though I'm not paying it, to make sure that the investment's still profitable at that. And that's great, because that effectively pulls forward the adjustment. So it's not really, not that you were necessarily suggesting it, but it's not really like an interest rate that we use to control monetary policy, where we might move it up, you know, one time, and then, you know, several months later or a year later, move it back down.
Yes, that's
what because we're dealing with shorter term fluctuations. This is a tax that's addressing a structural change in the economy, not something that's cyclical.
On the other hand, it'll presumably need to be something that's coordinated between different countries.
One of the challenges in the global transition is that some countries are going to move more rapidly than others, and maintaining or not the degree of openness and open trade between them could possibly become a bigger issue. And I think these are complex political issues that really have to be balanced through the political system, not outsource. You can't really outsource them to the technocrats. Our job is to make sure that the financial system is resilient and ready to adjust to those types of changes.
Well, thank you very much, Mark. That's been a fascinating discussion. Just to finish, I'd be interested to know, do you see the ultimate solution to climate change as involving adaptation of our current economic system, or, as some people claim, do we need to have fundamental change? Is it possible to be green and capitalist, or are we going to have to renounce capitalism in its current form in order to become green?
Well, I think, it's a deep question. I think we're going to absolutely require markets for much of the adjustment that's necessary. We need the innovation. We need the new technologies, ultimately, to effectively get to where we need to go. After all, net zero, the net in net zero requires, you know, commercial, at a minimum, something like commercial carbon capture and storage, for which, you know, there are techniques, but they're not as efficient. So we will need the market to innovate in a whole host of ways, experiment, make mistakes, lose money, make money in order to do it. So I think we need the core of the system to be there. At the same time, what we need is, through climate policy, to internalize these externalities that are at the heart of the challenge of climate change, both in space and in time, the tragedy of horizon, if you will, over time, to be brought in. And the whole process will be made more effective the more that individuals, all of us, are taking into account the scale of the issue and adapting how we invest, also how we consume. And but again, that will flow through the system. So the scale of the adjustment is enormous. The core of the system, properly supported, framed, directed, will, I think, still need to be the market system to be effective.
Thank you very much indeed. It's been very interesting to talk to you.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you for listening to Future Makers, and I hope you've enjoyed our series. By the way, if you haven't already checked out Season 1 of Future Makers, it was all on artificial intelligence. Find that on your usual podcast provider, and I hope you really like it. That's it for now, but we're hoping to return with some more bonus episodes in the new year, so watch out on your podcast provider. Until then, I'm Peter Millican, and you've been listening to Future Makers.